big day in Washington with what could be the closest vote ever on a president's cabinet nominee.
You go through the list and you think to yourself, this is the person who's going to head up the public school education of the United States of America in the 21st century. She's not prepared for the job.
That's Illinois Senator Dick Durbin on Betsy DeVos, President Trump's nominee for education secretary. We'll hear from both of Illinois senators today. Also, some of President Trump's newest executive orders aim to roll back regulations on Wall Street. We talked to law professors Stephen and Mary Ramirez about their new book on white-collar crime. And we remember the oldest aquarium fish in the world that died in Chicago yesterday.
One of my staff members made him a cake out of fish and vegetables because they are omnivorous. It's a really cute cake with carrots and raspberries on top.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Up next, the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This morning in Washington, D.C., the Senate is voting on President Trump's nominee for Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. It's looking like it will be the closest vote on a president's cabinet nominee in the history of the United States. So today we're going to hear from our Illinois senators on this issue. Early this morning, after a long night of Democrats holding the floor in opposition to that nomination, Illinois Senior Senator Dick Durbin joined WILL's Brian Moline. Senator Durbin had this to say about why he doesn't support DeVos as the president's nominee for education secretary.
What a pathetic demonstration at her hearing. Senator Alexander of Tennessee really went out of the way to protect her. He said, 1 5-minute round, that's it, no extra questions of Ms. DeVos. He knew that he was dealing with the witness on the stand who really couldn't handle questions. And she just so many times showed herself unprepared to lead this department. She didn't understand IDEA, a basic federal mandate to local school districts to make sure disabled kids have a fighting chance. When she was asked almost a throwaway question about guns in schools, her rationale had something to do with the threat of grizzly bears in public schools. I mean, you go through the list and you think to yourself, this is the person who's going to head up the public school education of the United States of America in the 21st century. She's not prepared for the job.
We also heard from Senator Durbin on President Trump's recent executive order banning immigrants from 7 different Muslim-majority countries. Here's why Senator Durbin thinks President Trump's executive actions are vastly different from immigration orders that President Obama made.
It's different because it's right out of the box, first 2 weeks of the presidency, an executive order which basically establishes a travel ban for 7 different nations, all majority Muslim, from a president who during his campaign was explicit that he wanted to ban Muslims from coming into the United States. And then after his executive order went on a Christian broadcasting show and said, we will show favoritism toward Christian refugees. These statements during the campaign and on that Christian broadcasting show are inconsistent with who we are as Americans. It gets to the fundamentals of religion in this great nation and how we've kept it together over 2 centuries when others have fallen apart on this issue. So, yes, I think this is critically important. It was heartbreaking for me to go up to the suburbs of Chicago on Sunday with a meeting of about 900 Muslim families, mothers, dads, and children, and to see the look in their eyes as they realize that this executive order is saying we want no more Muslim children like those who've gathered here in Villa Park. That, to me, is troubling, and I hope the courts will continue to stop this ban from going forward.
That's Illinois Senior Senator Dick Durbin. Of course, some federal judges will begin hearing oral arguments today in the challenge to President Trump's executive orders on immigration. Illinois' newest and junior senator, Tammy Duckworth, just before the vote started, the vote has started now, spoke minutes ago from the Senate floor about how she feels about the DeVos nomination.
I do not believe that the president nominated the best candidate to serve as Secretary of Education. I don't believe he even nominated a qualified candidate. Ms. DeVos has never taught, never worked in a school system, and has no educational degree in education policy. I was hoping that she would ease my concerns over her qualifications at her confirmation hearing and prove that she was indeed up to the job. But instead, Ms. DeVos failed to study, showed up unprepared, and appeared unfamiliar with a foundational civil rights law that guarantees every student, including those with disabilities, the right to a quality, equitable education. I wouldn't be here today were it not for strong public schools and civil rights protections. Confirming her to lead the agency tasked with educating our children and helping them develop into successful adults would be a mistake for our children, because they would have to pay for and live with this mistake for decades to come. There's simply no way that I can support her nomination. And I asked the senator, how is it possible that we could have a Secretary of Education who does not understand or even know about those federal protections for students with disabilities to have access to equitable and fair education?
Again, that's Illinois' newest and junior Senator Tammy Duckworth. We're going to be hearing a little bit more from Senator Duckworth in just a few minutes. But as we said, that vote is now taking place on the Senate floor in Washington. President Trump's nominee for Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, looking like it's going to be the closest vote on a president's cabinet nominee in the history of the United States. Joining me now, Amanda Vinicky, as WTTW politics reporter. Hey, Amanda, welcome back to the 21st. Amanda?
Yes.
Good morning. Good morning.
How? Hi, good morning.
Good morning. I know you are on your way to Springfield, but before we get to Springfield, I wanted to start with asking you about Washington. How have you seen the Illinois delegation in Washington reacting to the events of the past 2 weeks? We just heard from both of our senators, from Senator Durbin and Senator Duckworth. And what are we hearing from everyone in the delegation about how they've been mobilizing, obviously the majority Democrat delegation, about how they've been responding to the first 2 weeks of President Trump being in office?
No surprise. I think it's a lot of outrage, frustration, and we'll continue to see that. It echoes really what you've seen across the country. You noted Illinois does have a majority of Democrats in its congressional delegation, as it does in the state legislature. By and large, we are just still a very blue state, and you're seeing all of, I think, the, again, I'll use the term outrage against the Trump administration, the actions that he's taken, his appointments. And what you're seeing also is Democrats trying, I think, to drive a wedge already politically as well. So there are Republicans who are from districts that very much supported Donald Trump, even in the primary. But then there are others who are more moderate, where they'll have to walk a fine line. You're seeing Democrats, for example, with protests outside of Congressman Peter Roskam's office up in the suburbs of Chicago. And then also, frankly, Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan calling on Governor Bruce Rauner to do more to take a stand against the executive order on refugees and immigrants, saying that she wants Rauner to come out and refuse to follow the executive order and say that Illinois, basically sworn law enforcement officers, should not be turned into federal immigration officers. I think we're going to see that play out. Obviously, Rauner has got a re-election coming up in 2018, and Democrats are already, I think, going to be doing all they can to try and turn the tide in Washington. Trump himself may have a four-year term, but you'll have the U.S. House up again in just a couple of years, and this will be, I think, Democrats' opportunity to try to take that back, and they're already going to be looking to it.
Amanda, if you can hold on just a second. Earlier, a couple of minutes ago, I had an opportunity to speak with Senator Duckworth before she headed out to the floor. Let's hear from her. This is Senator Tammy Duckworth.
Good morning. How are you? Is this Nyla?
It is. So, Senator, you just said on the floor, I was just listening to what you were saying, that you were hoping that what the Secretary nominee DeVos, you were hoping that she could ease your concerns that you had about her originally. Why didn't she do that during the confirmation hearings?
Well, she just performed so poorly, and her answer specifically on the IDEA law, the law that requires schools to provide access that is equitable for students with disabilities. And we're not talking about just students with physical disabilities or learning disabilities. It's all disabilities. And she knew nothing about it. And this is a cornerstone of civil rights for children with disabilities, so that they can go to school, whether they have ADHD, autism, or perhaps are wheelchair bound. They have the right to go to school, and she knew nothing about this law.
I wanted to just switch topics and ask you, federal judges are hearing oral arguments today in the challenge to of President Trump's executive orders on immigration. I just wanted to ask, you know, I've heard the president and many of his supporters say that these actions are to make the country safe. In fact, yesterday we had a gentleman on the program from Stonington, Illinois, say that. You yourself being a veteran, I want to ask you how you think these orders impact our troops overseas.
I think this Muslim ban has further endangered our troops, not just our troops overseas, but Americans who are living and traveling abroad. You know, the seven countries that he targeted specifically, we have never had a single incident of an immigrant, of a refugee from one of those countries conducting terrorism in an act of terrorism in the United States. So there's no history of it. And then on top of that, we have now, with this Muslim ban, given ISIS a major talking point in their recruiting. And so we've just made our American men and women in uniform more of a target, and also Americans who are traveling all over the world who are either, you know, just being tourists on a well-earned vacation or working overseas. If you're going to target Americans, the place to do it is going to be overseas more so than in the United States. And that's and we've just given the enemy more of a reason to recruit people to come and hurt Americans.
Okay. And I know you're just headed to the floor now. The vote's going to be coming up for nominee DeVos. Thanks for taking the time to be with us this morning, Senator Duckworth.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That was Senator Duckworth just about 15 minutes ago before she headed down to the floor to the vote. That vote is going on right now for the president's cabinet nominee for Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Amanda Vinicky is with us, WTTW politics reporter. Amanda, we were just before that conversation with Senator Duckworth, you and I were talking about Governor Rauner. He actually sent a letter in support of Betsy DeVos to Washington. Is that correct?
That is correct. He was a signatory along with several other governors. And what they said was that they believe that DeVos will be an advocate for measures that they support. Hence, they, quote, strongly support her. And that is things along the lines of competition in schools, be it private or public or charter or what have you. Also that they believe she will help to streamline federal bureaucracy. And then this is something that you hear a lot from Governor Bruce Rauner, the notion of giving power back to local governments. And they say they believe DeVos will try to remove some of the federal government's authority over schools and education and give it back to states and local governments.
Well, and it's interesting. It's interesting to hear Governor Rauner say that, certainly, because it also reflects, I guess, the ideological debate, right, that we're seeing. Whether we've just heard, that's a very different opinion what Governor Rauner has than what we just heard from Senator Duckworth and Senator Durbin. And it really is an ideological, philosophical difference about public education in this country, isn't it, Amanda?
Very much so. And I think that while Rauner has been stunted, the impasse has sort of just brought everybody's attention to bear on Illinois having no budget, and so you're not seeing action in other promises that he made on the campaign trail. But it's clear that that had been one of the governor's top goals, and presumably we will see a reinvigorated movement by the Rauner administration in terms of expanding either charter networks or choice vouchers, what have you, in schools. That's something that his own education, basically, secretary had said was a top priority for the administration. You just had, you know, this gubernatorial education funding task force that didn't really come up with any sort of solution on that. And perhaps Illinois won't need to take action. This, as with so many other cases, you know, you see, for example, right to work. That is, Missouri is now a right-to-work state. Illinois is not. That's something the Chamber of Commerce has talked about, not specifically just right-to-work, but along those lines in terms of making Illinois business more competitive. The governor had talked about that early in the days of an administration and just yesterday reiterated that that's not something he's pushing any longer, but maybe he won't have to with a Republican president and a Republican Congress, Republican U.S. Senate. There will be a lot that could change at the federal level that will then flow back to states, including, of course, Illinois.
Right. Amanda, we just have a minute or two. We have about 2 minutes left, but because we're talking about education, I just wanted to ask you, and by the way, just a live update on the vote. It's about It's 39 no, 27 yes. We are sort of expecting that this will be a tie, but you never know what's going to happen until the vote gets taken for this is, again, Betsy DeVos to be President Trump's nomination for education secretary. Just to shift the focus back to Illinois, just for our last 2 minutes here, Amanda, we did have that report about school funding. I'm thinking in particular this focus on K through 12 education. We've heard everyone say that the system of how funding happens in Illinois is kind of a mess. Do you have any sense that this week we'll see any action in the state house on this? Or is this issue, you think, just too big apart from the budget impasse? What do you think will happen?
I'm sure you've talked about this quote-unquote grand bargain that Senate President John Cullerton and Senate Republican Leader Christine Rodonio have drafted that evidently will now contain a specific new formula, new way to fund schools. We haven't seen it yet, so don't know what is included, but President Cullerton did say that he will brief senators on that today and promised a vote, at least in part or in full. We'll have to remain to see what goes on in Springfield this week, but legislators will return today and they'll be there through Thursday. And education funding, as I said, is expected to be a part at least of that Senate plan. But yes, this is notoriously tricky and will continue to be so.
Amanda Vinicky, our former Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief. You're still in the public media family. She's with WTTW in Chicago, headed to Springfield. Amanda, thanks for joining us. It's always great to have you on with your analysis.
But of course, great to be with you guys.
Coming up, we're going to be continuing following events in Washington by talking to two law professors, one of them based here in Illinois. They've got a new book out about white-collar crime, and their question is, does too big to fail also mean too big to prosecute? We're going to speak to them about that, about proposed changes to the Dodd-Frank Act coming up. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We'll keep you updated on this vote as well and come back at the end of the hour with what's happening on that vote. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Does too big to fail also mean too big to prosecute? The idea that fraud caused the financial collapse of 2008 and the ensuing Great Recession isn't a new one. It was, in fact, one of the tenets of the Occupy Wall Street movement, something often discussed by candidate Bernie Sanders during this past presidential campaign. But what really should have been done about that? And why aren't people who commit financial crimes subject to more criminal prosecution? The price for white-collar crime should be higher, so argues a husband and wife legal duo, which includes one former Securities and Exchange Commission enforcement official and a former Federal Department of Justice antitrust prosecutor. Stephen Ramirez is the Associate Dean of Loyola University's Law School and the Director of its Business Law Center. Mary Ramirez is a professor of law at Washburn University, and they're the authors of the newly released The Case for the Corporate Death Penalty, Restoring Law and Order on Wall Street. Both of them are on the line with me now. Mary, Stephen, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having us.
I feel like I have to start by asking you about the actions that President Trump has begun to take to dismantle the Dodd-Frank Act, which is a series of financial industry regulations that were passed during the Obama administration. There's also been talk I've seen recently about halting implementation of a rule that would require, again, this is an Obama era administration rule that would require financial advisors to act in the best interests of their clients. Let's start with the Dodd-Frank Act as it exists today. Why do you feel like that's an important rule to protect consumers and the American public and the economy?
Well, I think first and foremost is the Dodd-Frank Act came into being in the summer of 2010. The regulators have been busily promulgating regulations to implement it. And here we are in 2017 with no major subsequent financial disruption that caused the kind of unemployment or economic dislocation that you saw in 2009. So, you know, on some levels, we can debate and speculate about the efficacy of the Dodd-Frank Act, but I like to look at history and I like to focus on legal and regulatory frameworks that actually work well in delivering the kind of economic performance that the American people deserve. And Dodd-Frank has worked. So in terms of why we would want to roll the dice on going back to a pre-2007 legal reality when we know that that legal reality did not work and it caused the near collapse of capitalism on a global basis is just beyond me.
And I'm also thinking of agencies that were created even prior to this. I'm thinking about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that was created in the wake of the Enron scandal. There's been talk of that being dismantled. What kind of impact do you think that would have?
Well, you know, the 2007, 2008, 2009 crisis was really a crisis in the mortgage market. And one of the things that Dodd-Frank did is it gave power to regulatory agencies like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to regulate credit markets in a way that made sense and that was sustainable and made sure that predatory lending, like what we saw during the height of the subprime crisis, did not occur again. And in fact, once again, it seems to be working pretty well, the idea of a qualifying mortgage. Interest rates in residential mortgage market are at a near record low, and people seem to be buying housing in a way that makes sense and is sustainable. And there's been far fewer predatory home loans made recently relative to what we saw in 2005, 2006, and 2007. So again, why would we gamble with this? Why would we gamble with success? There are things wrong with the economy. I don't think that Dodd-Frank is one of them.
And all of these changes get to a point that you all make in your book, that as you're saying, Dodd-Frank is a framework, but it also didn't create any, to your mind, to your writing, any significant criminal liabilities. And the premise of your book is the point that massive fraud and other crimes caused the financial crisis of 2008 and that the government let the perpetrators get away with it. And I want to ask both of you, what made you want to write this book?
Well, I think at first we were waiting for the government to address it directly without us even having the need to write the book. In fact, we sat back for a while watching and reading and waiting like the rest of the American public, expecting that, like in other financial crises, that indeed the government would come through not only to help to remedy what had gone wrong, but also to address the wrongdoing by the individuals and actors who seem to have spearheaded the problems.
And I think when we think about the mortgage crisis, I think many people instinctively realize that that was fraud. I'm thinking of my time when this was happening. I was in Florida as a reporter. I was a business reporter working for the Miami Herald. And I know a lot of my colleagues did lots of great reporting on people who were literally went from being convicted felons to selling mortgages and how little that was regulated in Florida before the housing bubble collapsed. But can you explain why you think, and this is obviously this is a big question, this is the whole question of your book, why we haven't seen the level of criminal prosecutions that we have seen in previous crises like the savings and loan. I'm thinking of the junk bond, even more recently Enron. We saw pretty significant criminal prosecutions out of that. Why didn't that happen this time?
Well, I think our book is a first draft of history in trying to explain exactly that question. And that means necessarily that we don't have the information that's going to be available 10, 15, 20 years from now. But based on what we are looking at historically in terms of financial crises and prosecutions in the Enron series of financial frauds in the savings and loan crisis, it's almost impossible to explain this other than through a focus on the tremendous concentration of money and political power that the largest Wall Street banks now wield. I think that at a certain level, it's very, very difficult to go after the largest organizations and largest concentrations of money in the world, basically. And when you think about a Chase Bank or a Goldman Sachs or a Citigroup, it's hard to imagine an organization with more financial wherewithal than those organizations. And so I think at some level, it becomes a politically based decision to preserve potential networks and future opportunities and future supports and future career positions. So really, I think it's a classic case of what economists recognize in collective action dynamics, and that is that as more and more wealth is concentrated or controlled by fewer and fewer people, those people can be expected to use the full panoply of political influence to advance their interests at the cost of the general welfare. And I think that's what we saw in the run-up to the crisis in terms of legal frameworks being subverted by power. And I think it's what we saw after the crisis in terms of the government's response to patent and manifest wrongdoing.
I want to get to the political ties and the contribution and all of that in a minute, because I think that is an important part of this. But Mary, I wanted to ask you a question, because you work for the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice, and we all heard the sort of the too big to fail. Do you think that there's also the sense that banks were too big to prosecute?
Well, certainly that was the assertion that was made, it would seem, by Eric Holder. But I do not necessarily think the banks are too big to prosecute, and I'm firmly convinced that the individuals running the banks are not too big to prosecute. I think one can lead to the other, since a corporation cannot act without its individuals. And so I think that the real key is to look at what individuals did and then to assess whether or not the bank has to be held accountable for that as well. Certainly there are consequences when a large corporation faces criminal prosecution that can be devastating, can be in fact the death penalty for a corporation, but I don't think that prosecuting the individuals could possibly lead to the death penalty for a corporation unless the prosecution chooses to go that route. So, no, I don't believe that the individuals were too big to prosecute, and I think there may have been some regulatory opportunities to address the bank issues.
Well, and before we get to those regulatory opportunities, I'm thinking in particular of when you call the corporate death penalty, and I think our most recent example of this in recent history is Arthur Andersen, again, regarding Enron as an example of that. Can you fill us in on how that came about, the whole prosecution of Arthur Andersen, what ultimately led to the demise of Arthur Andersen, or at least that iteration of the accounting firm?
Sure. So Arthur Andersen was a public accounting firm, one of the major public accounting firms in the U.S. at the time, and it had been advising Enron, working with Enron on its accounting measures. And since Enron is a public corporation, it is required that they have oversight by an accounting firm, public accounting firm. So at the time when Enron collapsed, when the bankruptcy occurred, it became apparent that there was going to be an investigation into what caused the problems at Enron. And as a part of that, Arthur Andersen would have recognized that sooner or later they would be looking to Arthur Andersen for information. At that point, Arthur Andersen began shredding documents related to its advising of Enron. So that shredding documents really led to an investigation of Arthur Andersen and ultimately led to prosecuting Arthur Andersen in particular for trying to destroy the evidence that was associated with the collapse of Enron. So a criminal prosecution erupted, but it didn't come first. Arthur Andersen had already had issues with questionable advising and perhaps participation in unlawful conduct at some other places, at Sunbeam in particular, and Waste Management. And so they had already been under the microscope of the Department of Justice. This was really the third major corporation coming to the attention of the Department of Justice. And before the Department of Justice went to prosecution, it first attempted to settle the case with Arthur Andersen, and Arthur Andersen rejected those attempts. It really wasn't a situation where the Department of Justice went in and immediately said, let's go prosecute this company. But in light of their prior activity and their unwillingness to cooperate with the government, the Justice Department concluded that it needed to go forward with the criminal prosecution. The Department of Justice won at the district court level, but ultimately on appeal, the case was reversed in large part due to the fact that there was jury instruction that was challenged as being overstating the law.
Well, and so I wonder, I wonder how much of that, I mean, when we talk about sort of the regulatory framework, one of the problems you all write about this, the difficulty in proving intent to fraud, is it that, or the intent to defraud someone, or is it, as you mentioned, Mary, is it juries and having a jury have to decide something that may end up being a rather complex financial structure that people are trying to navigate through? Or should it be something as simple as they tried to defraud people? Here's the evidence for that.
Well, I think the intent to defraud is by far the most difficult issue facing government, law enforcement, and the financial sector in the face of financial frauds. I think with respect to Andersen, the evidence on intent to defraud, known in securities jargon as scienter, was pretty powerful. And the reversal was not that the jury got it wrong on intent to defraud. The reversal was that the jury had been instructed incorrectly by the judge. And that's why Arthur Andersen's case was ultimately reversed Of course, at that point, Anderson had already suffered a criminal conviction. In the United States, as a matter of longstanding law, you don't allow firms that have been criminally convicted of wrongdoing to act as certified public accountants and to audit the financial statements of publicly held companies, as Mary stated. And so they suffered, in the end, the ultimate penalty. They were no longer allowed under state law to operate as an accounting firm. And our book sort of takes that as an example of what could have happened in the financial sector. So you used the term too big to fail, and does that become too big to jail? The whole point of our book is there need not be any too big to jail because there need not be any too big to fail. And the reason is because if a firm is committing financial frauds of the magnitude of what we've seen in the financial sector during the financial crisis, then it too faces that same Arthur Anderson problem, that same penalty. And that is you basically can lose your charter to engage in the banking business, to be an insured depository institution, or be forced to spin off affiliates to your shareholders, which really, if you think about it, doesn't harm anyone other than the current managers who now have to face the music for their criminal wrongdoing.
But there is a sense that this will somehow harm the economy. I mean, it does seem like whether that's something that, and I'm thinking of President Obama's words after the Lehman Brothers collapse, like I just sort of, I feel like there's a sense out there, whether it comes from politicians or Wall Street insiders or others, that this somehow will have a detrimental effect on our overall economy.
I don't think so. So take, for example, a large bank like Citigroup. If Citigroup were, and again, I'm just using this as a hypothetical, were found to be criminally responsible for significant wrongdoing within its financial services business, then based on the law that we highlight in our book, one of the remedies could be that they would be forced to spin off affiliates. And you could spin off affiliates to shareholders. You know, my mother had shares in AT&T. When AT&T was broken up, she thought it was great from a shareholder point of view. I think the same thing is true with respect to Standard Oil. If you look at shareholders in Standard Oil, after it was broken up, they became shareholders in Mobil and Exxon and all kinds of different affiliates of the former Standard Oil. So shareholders win because companies that previously were so large that they presented managerial difficulties become more dynamic. And in terms of the economy, the question really becomes, does it make sense for the full faith and credit of the United States government to stand behind any company on a relatively open and notorious basis? I don't think it does. I think that if a company does, in fact, get guaranteed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, there are government agencies and their CEOs should be on government pay scales. To let people take advantage of that government guarantee so that they can privatize it and use it to build gargantuan businesses by attracting more capital than otherwise that they can then use to justify soaring salaries really makes no sense at all. So our proposal of the corporate death penalty on Wall Street, I'm having a hard time figuring out who would be victimized by that other than a small handful of CEOs who probably have no right to be running such financial firms anyhow, given the record of what happened during 2007, 2008, and 2009.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. That's Stephen Ramirez with Mary Kreiner Ramirez as well. They're the authors of The Case for the Corporate Death Penalty, Restoring Law and Order on Wall Street. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Budu. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guests are Mary Kreiner Ramirez and Stephen Ramirez. They're both law school professors. They're the authors now of The Case for the Corporate Death Penalty, Restoring Law and Order on Wall Street. Mary Kreiner Ramirez teaches law at Washburn University. Stephen Ramirez is the associate dean of Loyola University's law school, where he's also the director of its Business Law Center. We're talking about this whole concept of too big to fail, as they've said, too big to jail. And I wanted to ask you, Stephen, something you brought up just before we took a break, which is the whole notion of post-2008 financial crisis, how much money different Wall Street entities have put into different political campaigns. And this is obviously a bipartisan issue. If you go back, whether we're talking about President Clinton or President Obama or President Bush in terms of how pro-Wall Street their policies have been, I'm thinking in particular of the repeal, for example, of Glass-Steagall under the Clinton administration. Where do you see the political will to change this when there's so much of these so deep ties between Wall Street and politicians in Washington?
Well, that's an excellent question. One of the reasons why we wanted to write this book is we felt a public duty as law professors, which we both, I think, view as privileged positions, to sort of notify the public, the voting public, of what's going on with respect to the rule of law in our country. And really, the effort boils down to gathering as much information as we could get our hands on from as many reliable sources as possible and weaving it together into a theme that would illustrate that we suffered this historic breakdown in the rule of law. Now, that breakdown in the rule of law coincided with the financial sector getting very large relative to our economy in general, and the largest financial institutions becoming very large relative to the financial sector in general. And as a result, it's not just about political campaign contributions, lobbying expenditures. It's about things like being able to offer job opportunities that just aren't generally otherwise available. So, for example, one of the things that we include in our book is the story of Robert Rubin, who went from Goldman Sachs to Treasury Secretary in the Clinton administration to Vice Chairman of the Board of Citigroup. And in a 10-year period, Robert Rubin made $126 million in compensation payments. There just aren't that many jobs out there that can be given to people in exchange for, shall we say, political accommodations, or maybe not even an exchange, but just sort of like a tacit understanding or just a hope, right? So, you know, honestly, we're not saying that the incentives that gave rise to this fiasco and that the incentives that are in place means that these people are somehow inherently evil. We think that incentives are the problem. And these incentives are relatively new because of the relative newness of the size of the financial sector compared to how it has been throughout U.S. history. And that, to us, at least as a first draft of history, pending the release of more documents and FOIA litigation, and who knows what we're going to learn in the next 10 years about what happened in the Obama administration. But our point is that these kinds of realities do sway regulators. They do have an impact on policymakers and lawmakers. And when you can offer someone a job that pays $126 million over 10 years, that really affects the way people approach various issues that they're looking at. And it doesn't just affect Robert Rubin. It's a message that reverberates throughout our government and throughout policymakers and lawmakers generally. And I don't mean to pick on the Democrats. If you would like, I could come up with plenty of situations where the Republicans also benefited from the largesse of Wall Street. This is
That's okay, because I was going to ask you about our new Republican president. So we can do that, because I'm speaking with Stephen Ramirez and Mary Kreiner Ramirez. They are the authors of The Case for the Corporate Death Penalty. Both of you propose ideas like creating a corporate fraud division of the Department of Justice. You talk about amending Dodd-Frank. I can't help but think of how we started this conversation with what we're already seeing with President Trump rolling back regulations you all already see as insufficient. So I guess my question is, how do you see this playing out over the next 4 years in terms of a regulatory environment for Wall Street?
Well, you know, the president is our president. And so, therefore, I want the president to be the best president possible. He came into Washington on the platform that he was going to drain the swamp. Our book is a handbook on how to do that. It's a roadmap. And it's my profound hope that he cashes the check that he wrote during the campaign, that, you know, he knows the system better than anyone. He knows where the problems are and he knows how to fix it. We're going to try to give him a little hint on how to help that. And if that happens, that would be great. But if it turns out that instead he repeals Dodd-Frank and eliminates regulation without reimposing any kind of accountability for wrongdoers, that would be exactly the wrong turn.
And certainly that's what we've seen if we're looking at news reports for the past couple weeks and things that President Trump has said. He said, look, there's too many regulations on Wall Street. That's certainly what we've heard from him in the past week or two.
Yeah, I think that's true. But, you know, if we restore criminal accountability, if we impose the corporate death penalty the way that Congress intended, and if we do things like make securities fraud litigation a real threat to corporate and financial elites again, maybe we can have a financial sector that once again serves the needs of the nation rather than operate to aggregate huge masses of capital that serve to rule the nation.
Mary, do you think that nuance exists in the conversation about regulation over Wall Street? Are there distinctions between overall regulation of the industry versus criminal prosecution of criminal acts?
Oh, well, I think there are distinctions between the two. I think it's kind of do you want to address things before they happen or after they happen? When we talk about regulatory measures, those are requirements put in place both to limit the sort of conduct that businesses can engage in that could be harmful to the economy, for example, in regulating banks, and also to provide oversight to make sure that banks are complying with those limits. And the hope is by having a regulatory agency that can oversee that and has guidance through statutory directives that we won't find ourselves in a crisis. We won't find people engaging in criminal activity. Once they've engaged in the criminal activity and the crisis occurs and people are losing money and homes and things like that, well, frankly, it's a little late because the harm has been done and the benefit to the individuals who walk away with a lot of money is usually less than the harm that is created for everyone else. So you hope not to reach the criminal side of it. And certainly for years, as corporations have argued against criminal penalties for corporations, they have argued that, you know, you have all this regulatory oversight. You really don't need to go to this direction. And we're not really people anyway. We're just corporations. Frankly, they are two different things. One is the effort to stop the conduct before it occurs, to discourage conduct. Once you get to the criminal side, things have already happened. And now we just need to use the criminal law to communicate the message that there is a limit with respect to what can be done to assure people who are harmed by the injury that there is consequence for that, just like we have in other areas of criminal law. It's a great way to clean house in the sense that one of the things that corporations will often offer in an effort to avoid criminal prosecution is to defer that sort of conduct while they take an opportunity to straighten up their act and clean house themselves.
Stephen, do you have a sense that that distinction exists, the distinction between is there a will, you think, in Washington right now to push maybe not other regulation, but regulation of criminal prosecution before it happens again?
I think it's too early to tell. My fear is that the new administration is going to pursue what I view as a roadmap to disaster, and that would be deregulate the financial sector and do nothing to restore accountability for people who are found to have engaged in wrongdoing, even criminal wrongdoing. You know, even the most conservative libertarian would tell you that while regulation ex ante, up front, that applies to all is bad, regulation ex post in the form of fraud remedies and criminal accountability and civil accountability makes sense because that only applies to the people who actually engage in wrongdoing. One of the things that happened in the run-up to the financial sector is we had both deregulation up front and deregulation ex post in terms of accountability. I think it'll be very telling if this administration goes down the road of deregulating the financial sector and doing nothing to impose or restore accountability, then we'll know that the drain the swamp rhetoric was really just another instance of a politician making promises they had no intention to keep.
And what do you think the consequences of that are if that would indeed be the case?
I'm extremely fearful that if we go back to a pre-Dodd-Frank regulatory reality in terms of upfront regulation, and we maintain this approach that is now far more open and notorious than it was in the past, that these folks do not have to worry about accountability or being subject to the rule of law like 99.99% of the rest of America, that is a prescription for another financial crisis, one that could be even more devastating than 2008.
And how do you want people who are not in the financial industry, people who, both of you have a significant background, obviously not just in the law, but in prosecution and enforcement, whether that's in for the Department of Justice or for the Securities and Exchange Commission, how do you want people who maybe look at the financial crisis, who were either, whether they were affected personally or not, how do you want them to think about this issue?
Well, I would say, and I say this only a little bit, tongue-in-cheek, but let's make America great again. Let's make everyone subject to the rule of law. Let's impose accountability on Wall Street. Let's make the banks behave. Let's abolish too big to fail. It can be done. You know, the statute of limitations for the crimes that happened in 2007, 2008, and 2009 is 10 years. So the administration, the Trump administration, has time to pick up this battle and reimpose the rule of law on Wall Street. And even besides what happened in 2008, 2007, 2009, you've still got the recent wrongdoing at Wells Fargo that came to light. You've got all the foreclosure fraud, where you had a massive fraud on courts all across the country through robo-signing of false affidavits. You had the whole problem with the London whale trade. So I really think that there is plenty of time to restore law and order on Wall Street. Our book, it should give policymakers, regulators, and lawmakers serious pause about continuing this non-accountability approach to the financial sector. And I'm hoping that the Trump administration will pause before deregulating the financial sector without imposing any accountability.
That's Stephen Ramirez, a former Securities and Exchange Commission enforcement attorney, now Associate Dean at Loyola University's Law School and Director of its Business Law Center. Mary Kreiner Ramirez, former Department of Justice antitrust prosecutor, now teaches law at Washburn University. Their book is called The Case for the Corporate Death Penalty, Restoring Law and Order on Wall Street. Stephen, Mary, thanks for being with me.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you, Nalia. This was excellent.
Earlier in the show, we were talking about the confirmation vote for Betsy DeVos happening on the Senate floor. The vote's finished. Betsy DeVos has been confirmed as the next education secretary. As expected, it was a 50-50 split tie, which gave Vice President Pence the authority to cast a tie-breaking vote, which has confirmed her nomination. The first time in U.S. history a vice president's tie-breaking vote was needed to confirm a cabinet secretary. Reuters is also just reporting that a majority of Senate votes to limit debate on the attorney general nominee has also happened, which paves the way for confirmation later this week. Grandad, an Australian lungfish that may have been as old as 100, died yesterday, officials at Chicago's Shedd Aquarium said. Grandad was an adult when he arrived at Shedd in the early 1930s and may have been the oldest aquarium fish in the world. Michelle Sattler is the Shedd Aquarium's collections manager. She said more than 104 million guests had visited Grandad the fish over the past 84 years, making him one of the most recognizable characters at the aquarium.
Every day there's people that ask, direct me to where Granddad is. And he was individually identifiable because he had what we kind of jokingly refer to as age spots. But I think it's more indicative of it points towards a male animal. But the scales, he'd have darker, lighter, almost black scales. So he had a mottled look to him. So you could definitely point him out as an individual, and people really enjoyed that.
We'll tweet out a picture of Granddad so you can see what he looked like. Our handle, 21STShow, that's 21st show. Many who visited Granddad over the years have their own distinct memories of the animal and their interactions with him. Michelle shared one of her favorite memories as well.
One in particular was when we had a celebration for his 80th year here. One of my staff members made him a cake out of fish and vegetables because they are omnivorous. They'll kind of forage for anything. But it was a really cute cake with carrots and raspberries on top and fish building the sides. And we had the Australian consulate come out. There were guests. There were staff. There were volunteers. So it was really a neat moment in history.
That's Michelle Sadler from the Shedd Aquarium. Thanks to WBEZ's Ben Thomas Payne for that audio. That does it for today. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a great day.